Hello and welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, the CineLinks podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the best way is to email me at steve@cinelinks.com, or you can always find me on Twitter at SteveDunk5 or at EverythingCanon. Today in the show, I'm talking to Margot Wood all about her debut novel, Fresh, which is described as a hilarious and vulnerable coming-of-age story about the thrilling new experiences and missteps of a girl's freshman year of college. While Fresh may be Margot's debut novel, she's definitely not new to publishing, having worked in the industry on the marketing side for over 10 years. Now, on the other side of the table, she gives us a real hard look at the sometimes messy and sometimes complicated world of being a freshman in college. Because much of the story is taken from Margot's actual experiences, the book has this added personal weight to it, which definitely comes across in the book's unique form. We talk about some of the do's and don'ts of a debut author, how people will react to the book's lead character, Elliot, how much of the story mirrored Margot's own life, Fresh's interesting style, and much, much more. While this is a spoiler-free discussion, the odd minor detail may slip out, so if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled at all, better stop listening now. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As always, around these parts, we encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves. Each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or face-to-face, or each time we participate in the market with our purchasing choices, and this, of course, should be done all year long. As a reminder that August is Black Business Month, so get out there and support Black-owned businesses. I'm partial to independent bookstores myself, so safely seek out any Black-owned independent bookstores close to you or online and give them some of your money. I will post a link after the show so you can do just that very thing. Okay, Margot Wood has been a publishing marketing professional since 2009, and some of you will know her from her days at the young adult site Epic Reads, which she founded and was the original manager of for 5+ years. She was born and raised in Cincinnati, Ohio, graduated from Emerson College in Boston, and after living in New York City for 10 years, she moved to Portland, Oregon, where she remains. She's here today to talk about her debut novel, Fresh, which is described as a hilarious and vulnerable coming-of-age story about the thrilling new experiences and missteps of a girl's freshman year of college. Please welcome to the show, Margot Wood. Hi, Margot.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Have you done any of these yet? Is this the first? This can't be the first one.
No, this is like my fourth podcast at this point.
Are you like, we'll talk about sort of, you know, you've been on the other side of this thing for so long. Like, have you gotten used to it? Is it still a little weird being like, you know, being asked the questions as opposed to asking them maybe, or?
Yeah. So I was not prepared. I thought the hardest part of publishing a novel would be the actual writing of the novel, but it turns out that part was actually the most fun. This part, the part that I'm a professional at. Right. Is hard. It's hard to talk about your own book when you're so used to promoting other people's stuff.
we'll definitely get into that, sort of the marketing side of it, and maybe even give some free advice to people out there, because you're still doing that. I mean, that's still your job, right?
It is still my job.
Right, the home of Rick and Morty.
Yeah, the home of Rick and Morty and T-Dragon Society and Scott Pilgrim.
But yeah, it is. I did watch your one video about you sort of realizing you would get the book when it was done and then like, here, market it. Mm-hmm. You hadn't realized how much goes on before that point. And
I had no experience with editorial other than in a marketing capacity,
right,
at the publishers that I work for. So I didn't know what the acquisitions process was like. I didn't know what the editorial like letter process was like. I didn't know how copy editing worked. I didn't know how any of it worked. I mean, my draft of Fresh was in Google Docs. That's how little I know.
It's like, again, you talk about this. I recommend people definitely checking out if they haven't already. I mean, you've been doing it for so long. It's really great. And it's just a great resource for people who are, you know, Lizelle Sambury has another great YouTube channel where she just really is just like paying it forward in a big way, right? Like helping people with all these little steps along the way. Did you, being in the business for so long on the marketing side, did that give you any advantage at all, do you think?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
It definitely gave me an advantage.
Give me a couple. So in that sense, then like, let's sort of do a little giveaway, a little free advice here, since this is your background and you're still doing it. And now that you're also a debut author yourself, reach out maybe to another author out there who's going to have a debut at some point in the future. If you like, give them one do and one don't.
one, do is get comfortable talking about your book.
Yeah.
I mean, that now I understand what that really means. But I also understand that from like the marketing side of things, it's really helpful if authors can be comfortable speaking about their own book in a variety of formats. So whether it's written or say on a podcast or at an event. One thing you definitely shouldn't do, honestly, don't look at your reviews. I've had a lot of authors that I've worked with on the professional side. No, seriously, like they look at their reviews and then they want to come back and change things at the 11th hour. Reviewer was like, I didn't like this one part, and then they panic, and then there's this whole thing. And sometimes, and we've had author, like we've, you know, acquiesced to that, and it sets the whole timeline back. All the marketing basically becomes moot at that point because you've done all this stuff and then everything goes back. So just don't read your Goodreads reviews. Like, seriously, just don't.
It's a funny thing. And I, you know, talk to a lot of authors, obviously. And, you know, I am very pro author. And I always say that too. I'm like, don't go to Goodreads. Don't read anything. You know, maybe read a couple of the bigger trades if you want to, right? But do yourself a favor and don't do it. And I said, if it helps, understand that most of these people have little to no credibility, right? Like, and I'm in that group, so I'm allowed to say that. I like understand, like, these things aren't full of Margot Woods you've read a lot of books at this point. You've immersed yourself in the business. You're in the business. It's your profession. It's your career, right? So you understand, you know, there's certain, you know, levels to this thing, certain mechanics involved to storytelling. You understand all of that. A lot of these people don't. And I think authors need to be, and I'll protect them on their behalf if I must, but they have to be a little bit more self-aware of that and understand, like, this, I'm even trying to think of some stupid handle on Goodreads, like this, you know, sexy lover 69 bunny cat, you know, like who by the way didn't even finish your book, you know, stopped at 37% or some random number, don't listen to what they're saying. I get it.
It is hard. Yeah. It's hard because you want to know if people like your shit. I mean, that's why you put it out there in the first place. But I always tell authors that I work with, the reviewing community is not for you. No. Like, once your book's out there and people start to pick it apart and review it, whether or not they're actually reviewing it from a critical lens or not, it's not for you. And the reviewing community is a very different community than I would even argue than say the reading community, and like Goodreads specifically, you know, like there's a lot of, it's like any social media platform. There's a lot of things going on behind the scenes that people are maybe posting because they want the review to become popular because then they become more popular. So like, there's a lot going on with a review that's more than just whether or not they liked your book. But that being said, I do really wish sites like obviously Amazon and Goodreads would get rid of star ratings, because I find the star rating so fascinating, because somebody will be like in the review, loved it, 3 stars.
Really? Here, I'd have this discussion with a good friend of mine too all the time. We talk about movies and TV shows necessarily, but to really do it justice, a star rating should really be out of 1,000.
Yeah, right? I agree. Or just get rid of it entirely.
Make it serious. I'm with you. Get rid of it altogether, because you're right. I mean, I'll be reading something, because you can only give so many things when you've only got 5 options and you review hundreds and hundreds of books and yada, yada, yada. Eventually, something you loved is going to get 4 stars, and something you weren't crazy about is going to get 4 stars, just by the law of averages, right? Mm-hmm. Just because of physics and science, you know what I mean? So yeah, and a lot of times you'll be reading something, you're like, well, you gave that 5 stars, you better give this 5 stars, because then now all of a sudden you're handcuffed to 4 stars for the rest of your fucking life, because you gave The Bells 4 stars, but then you just gave, like, Ready Player 2 4 stars as well. I don't know. I was trying to think of something not as good as The Bells, but it's like,
yeah. I mean, and everybody has a different criteria for what they consider a 4-star book versus a 3-star book versus a 5-star book. So I do find it, I am now of the mindset where I'm like, if I finish a book, because I'm a serial do not finisher, and if I finish a book, that's like an automatic 4 stars for me. Whether or not I enjoyed it doesn't even matter. The fact that they got me to the end is like a huge accomplishment. So
I actually think they should have an algorithm on things like Goodreads. And if you type the letters DNF, it locks you out of reviewing that book. Like, so, because I just think you forfeit the right to do it. I'm sorry. Especially like you see some too, right? Like 30%, 20%.
Yeah. I see that all the time.
And they still bother to like stick out an opinion. Like, no, sorry, fella or sister, you lost your chance. Sorry.
And what's frustrating from a publisher, like from the marketing perspective, especially over on Amazon, is you'll see people be like, this book was great, but the package delivered and it like the product itself was damaged. Right. So I'm going to give it 1 star. And I'm like, I wish you could just rate the seller, not like, cause then I feel bad because then, you know, that brings down the average of that book, even if they liked it and it's like a whole thing. So
well, a lot of those things you do send out a follow-up though and talk about like, and they want you to rate how was your experience and all that stuff too. True. Right. So there's opportunities to do that and people are just choosing not to use that. Right. So,
yeah,
but you're right. So, that's insanity. If you're because the package was late, you gave the book 1 star. Yeah.
But from a marketing, like on the other side of the aisle, we use reviews extensively as a form of, you know, qualitative marketing research, you know, because if a book is not doing well sales wise, then we're going to go look to the reviews to see why. And if there's a common thread among the reviews, the negative reviews, if everybody's saying like, oh, this book was great except for this one thing, then sometimes, especially with my work at Oni, we've gone back and reprinted the book, but fixed the problem. Right. And suddenly, you know, it solves that issue. But it's, you know, it's interesting because it's not always the case. A lot of times people are just all over the map with why they didn't like something, but every once in a while it'll be something very, very specific. Like, you know, in comics, they'll be like, I liked everything except for this one panel. And I'm like, well, that's easy to fix. Let's change that one panel.
Right. But again, you're doing it because you're getting enough. There's data there.
Exactly.
Like there's enough information to where you can make a decision. Whereas like you said, if it's like 50 different issues, you're like, well, we can't, you know, it's too late, but yeah. And a lot of times soon, as you know, because society changes and the way we look at things changes and, you know, gets updated, hopefully, and more progressive, hopefully, you know, we're allowed to go back and like change the way we refer to people. Right. Whether it's identity or we would just want to go back and erase Harry Potter from every other book, which I'm for. But you know what I mean. But that's an easy fix and that's something we can do. But yeah, like when you go in and you've got just a litany of things that are just like all over the map, you're like, we tried data mining this person, but it's not working out so well.
Yeah. So it's hard, especially with my own book, because, you know, on the one hand, I've got this marketing brain that's like trying to do all the same things that I would do for any other book that I'm working on, which is looking at the data, following it along, keeping up with the overall sentiment value of a title, but I can't really do that for my own book. I mean, I certainly started to at the beginning just out of routine, but then I was like, oh no, this is going to be bad for me. So I have a friend who goes through my reviews and she pulls out key things for me instead.
Yeah, it gets hard. And a lot of times too, people, like you said, are trying to brand themselves as bloggers and reviewers too, right? Mm-hmm. So they haven't, there's an agenda and that's fine. I mean, that's a big industry and all the power to them, right? So, I mean, Tor Books just pulled a couple of things for me today for She Who Became the Sun. And I just said to them, good on you, because like parsing my reviews are like, cause I swear a lot, even in my reviews. So I'm just like, good. You managed to find a sentence that was either coherent and didn't have swearing in it. So good job. All right. One thing I read too about you was you struggled with reading when you were younger. And it wasn't until later in life, actually, I think you were an adult, right? Were you in college, I think, maybe? Did I read that
after
wrong?
College.
After college.
I was 25 when I started to become a reader.
And you say it was because of young adult, essentially, if I correct me.
100%.
All right. So then tell me, why do you think it was YA that was the cure for your struggles? And then just in a more general sense, why do you love YA?
It was easy to read.
Right.
I could go wax on about all the other themes and blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
But the reality is that YA books are easier to read. Mm-hmm. They're quicker.
Not always.
No, nothing I say is like a
gospel,
a hard and fast rule, but a generalization is that like, it's
yes.
faster to get into the story because, again, those protagonists are younger. So it's easier to see yourself in a story of, you know, young girls who are around my age at the time. And
first person is a huge help too, for sure.
First person is a big help.
Yeah.
You know, just the pacing, overall pacing of a lot of YA, especially when I first started reading YA, I was reading dystopian. So the pace of dystopian novels is really lightning fast. And every chapter ends with a hook, and it had all these elements that like kind of help you become a binge reader. Like you're just like, I have to know more. And almost all the dystopian novels I was reading at the time were like that. So it really got me into and actually comfortable with reading. And that's how I became a much more confident reader. And then once I moved on from dystopian, then I was able to, you know, read other genres in YA and then started reading a little bit more adult and kind of mixing up, you know, the categories that I was reading. But it really was dystopian YA that really got me into it in the first place, because I love those stories of, you know, young people fighting. I love that shit.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like YA just because, you know, because I'm so cynical, I'm old and cynical and jaded and fucking hate everything and everybody. I just still like, I just cling to, and not to say this, it's the only, you know, category that does this, but just unbridled optimism and hope.
Yes.
You know, these kids aren't, you know, destroyed, beaten down by life yet. Their minds are still, are still somewhat fertile, you know, and middle grade even more so too. Right. So that's, I think, mostly why I'm attracted to it for sure. It's just that sense of hope and optimism, because I just, you know, you look out the window or turn on the TV and there's a serious lack of both. Right. So
absolutely.
Yeah. That's why, I mean, I'm still going to cling to, I still read tons of adult too and stuff like that, and gothic and horror and all these other not weird things that to keep me up at night. But that's, I think for me, that's the big thing. Yeah, for sure. Is that first person narrative is a big one. And just that general sense of hope is always something I'm going to be attracted to.
Yeah. And I was a late bloomer. So, you know, I didn't start reading YA until I was 25, but you know, so I'm a little bit, behind everybody else.
Right,
and,
right,
you know, I was catching up, you know, making up for lost time. So that's pretty much all I read for a long time was YA. I still read it. Well, not as much anymore, but I still do.
But that's, I think you see that too. I remember like, I think Hafsa Faisal said the same thing. Like she was a late bloomer. And when she found it though, it was just like, it was just 24 hours a day. Just nonstop reading. Cause then like, you're never going to catch up, right? Just because it's just the way there's just too many books in the world. But the floodgates were open. So again, having said all of that, what have you read lately or this year that's really stood out? Have you had time for reading? You're a writer now. Is that's got to put a hit. That's got to put an
end.
Yeah. Omoy, are you going to tell me you've read no books this year?
No, no.
Okay.
The one I just finished yesterday. I'm reading Ice Planet Barbarians.
Okay. No, that's cool.
It's that TikTok book that everybody's talking about. Yeah, and, you know, I've only read a handful of romance novels in my day. I've never read a science fiction romance novel. So I just wanted something fun and silly. So I just started reading that. And I was like, damn it. I'm mad that I liked this so much. So I did read that. I've been mostly reading a lot of adult stuff this past year. Because I'm, you know, for my next book, I think I'm going to make the transition over to adult. But
cool.
So I was reading Honey Girl. And then I read this amazing, just such a fucked up book, A Certain Hunger by Chelsea Summers. It's sort of like a female lady food critic who is also a cannibal serial killer.
Nice.
Told from first person perspective. And it is I've never read anything quite like it, except I would say the closest thing is American Psycho, but I found it much more interesting than American Psycho. I didn't even finish American Psycho because I was like, all right, we get it.
Yeah. He likes,
brands and death. Got it. Cool. I understand what this is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was like a really, really great book. I've just been reading a lot of standalones. I haven't read much by way of fantasy or anything lately. I've been getting a lot of adult, like I'm on adult mailing lists now for the first time ever in my career. So that's just been a lot of fun. So I've been working my way through a bunch of those cool. books.
Right on.
Yeah.
Good. I love it. A couple things there and for people to add to their list for sure. But then again, real quickly though, I have to assume your reading's taken a hit. I mean, you're on deadlines now.
My reading actually started to take a real hit. My dad died 5 years ago, and okay. That was peak Epic Reads days too. Yep. This was all happening at the same time.
Yep.
And I really had a hard time reading after he died. The attention span wasn't there. The focus wasn't there. The interest wasn't there. And so it took a real hit for a long time. And then I started writing fresh and went on submission and all that stuff and then editing. So yeah, then it kind of took over my life. And so I actually found myself finally getting back into reading now that like fresh is done. And, you know, I've moved on from the grief enough to be able to like focus on other things. It's been nice being able to pick up books again. So I've read more this year than I have probably in the last 4 years, yeah. 3-4 years.
Oh, it's life. It goes up and there's ups and downs, and you know, reading isn't always the answer to every, you know what I mean? So yeah, the numbers take a hit and they're different every year. Like that, these people that can do 250, even some are close to 300 every single year is astounding to me. I'm just like, you've had a good life because you had no trauma in your life whatsoever or an obscene amount. I can't decide.
I think a lot of it also has to do with the fact that I am way too much on screens. Screens are like the death of me. Phone is the worst. It's like the greatest thing, but it's also the worst thing for productivity.
Yes,
And it's so easy and it's right there and it's really hard to put it away. Right. I'm not good at it.
Yeah. Well, especially when you're like reading something that isn't super great and you're just like, oh, I got to get through this, but there's something what's on my phone right there. Damn it. Yeah,
exactly. I think the worst thing that could ever happen to a reader is you get into a reading slump. That is like the worst because it's so hard to come out of that because you feel like you've been burned. You know, you're like the last three books I tried were just bad or you just weren't in the right headspace for them. But it's hard to come out of a reading slump.
I was there about a month and a half ago and I had this good advice for another reviewer who was in the same thing. And I just said, go back and read something you love. Even if you've read it 1,000 times, go back.
That is my trick.
Yeah. Well. Mine too. Yeah. Remind yourself why you do this in the first place. Because, you know, remind yourself that how much you love storytelling and why you love storytelling and, you know, lean on people who are just really fucking good at it and let them heal your slump, you know? So
that's really also now one. My other thing that I do now is I look at the length of chapters before I start a book. If the chapters are long, yeah. I tend to not pick it up.
I'm the same way. I love short chapters.
Yeah.
If there's a book and they're like, it's 500 pages, but 200 chapters. I'm like, yes.
Yes, exactly. So I'm like sort of halfway through this historical novel, adult fiction novel that I don't normally read historical, but it's super short chapters. So I find myself totally sucked in, of course.
That's how I do long drives too. I break it up into like 10 little achievements, you know what I mean? Like if I have an 8-hour drive, I'm like, well, I know I'll get to this city in an hour and a half. And that's, yeah, I think it's easier for my really feeble brain to just break things up into smaller. And I'm like that with books too, right? I'm like, well, if I can get to this chapter by the end, you know, by the end of today or even in the next hour or two, you know, whatever my little mini goal is, it just helps me, helps my brain a lot more. But
low commitment.
Oh, I love it. I'm with you. we'll just put a pin in that, but I wrote a note down about the father relationship in this book, and I was going to ask if it was personal in some way, but we'll get to that in a second. So I'm going to tease you with it, and then we'll get to
it. All right.
Let's talk about though before we get to like the, you know, the details of the book. You know, this thing is very, talk about sort of your idea with this book, because I mean it's very, aside from the content, it's very, you know, I'm sure you've heard this already and I'm sure you're well aware of it since you wrote it. A lot of fourth wall breaks, a lot of, you know, talking to the camera, a lot of meta stuff going on, right? And especially because of the way you introduce the book, you know, you out front, flat out say, I've based a lot of this on my own personal experiences.
Yes.
You know, I think you even say at one point, use most of, not all, but most of the things that you wrote in that letter, which I would love to see to your sister. So in a sense, this book, right away, you're setting us up for this book being more of a memoir, but like autobiographical in a way. And you've even got like a couple of really cool choose your adventure type things going on in this book. But my thing, this hill I've been climbing on this year is, you know, you know, the ARCs get letters to the readers, right? To the reviewers and the,
right.
And I want those in the final copies. I'm sick of it because they're fucking really, they're always really great. They're meaningful. They're personal. There's great context there too, I think, for the reader, which all readers should have access to. I'm always encouraging people to post those online. And I ideally I'd like them in the final copy, but if not, I think they should be posted somewhere for people to read. Cause I think there's important information there. Cause I'm a cover to cover person too. So, anyways, you really, with the letter to the reader, it's really great, well-written, really personal. You really set this thing up. So it's like, when I'm reading this book, every time I see Elliot, I'm just thinking Margot. So, you know, talk to me about this process, because clearly, and again, with your father too, there's a really great father-Elliot relationship in this book. And talk to me about this, because this feels, I mean, you outright state it, but it just feels very personal.
Yeah, it started extremely personal. Yeah. Like, it started from my own life, and I've had some friends read it and they told me that at the beginning, all they can hear is my own voice. All they can see is me as Elliot. And then as they keep going, Elliot kind of morphs into her own person. And that's sort of what the writing experience was like for me with this process. I started with just a bunch of scenes based on some of those mistakes that I made in college. And I had no connecting tissue. I just had Elliot, the character who, you know, at the beginning was obviously like me as a freshman. And then a bunch of her friends, which were kind of based on some people I went to school with. And then, you know, the whole Emma architecture came in much later, after I already had about 30,000 words.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, it did not start out.
Okay.
Yeah, it did not start out as I have never taken a writing class. I was a marketing major. I did not grow up writing for fun. This is literally the first thing I've ever written.
Yep.
So I didn't know what plot was going to be. I knew what themes I wanted to explore. I knew what the general like idea of this story was and what messages and themes and things, all that stuff that I wanted to cover, but I didn't know what the connecting plot was. All I had was a bunch of random scenes and nothing that else was there.
Well, what did you query?
That
a bunch of random
you scenes asked me together. Earlier. Yeah. You asked me earlier if my career in publishing sort of helped me get to where I am with Fresh. And I got my agent because I had worked with her on many of her other books.
Right. Okay.
And we had a personal relationship because we had been on tours together and all this stuff. And I basically pitched her the idea with like, it was actually one scene that is still in the book. It's the scene where Nico is going down on Elliot and she's counting the ceiling tiles. That was what I sent this agent funny. To get her. That's how I got my agent.
That scene's funny. It is very funny. The whole book is very funny, by the way. And it's not, I shouldn't say the whole book. When you're trying to be funny, it's funny. There are some scenes that aren't funny.
Yes, but there's a handful of real scenes.
But they're not meant to be funny. If somebody says they laughed all the way through, then you're like, what? Anyways, but that particular joke comes back around later on in the book, and I thought that was very funny. But anyways.
Yeah, so that's sort of, that's how I got my agent. And so it was just, you know, she kind of was very patient with me, and I was like, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm just writing stuff and it's funny. And she just had full confidence in me and kind of was just patient, was like, just let me know when you've got it where it needs to be. Right. And in order to get to where I needed to be, I had to step back and tell myself that I was trying to reinvent the wheel. I was trying to come up with a plot that was unique and original. And I'm like, there's only 7 different story types out there.
Yes. Thank you. I say that all the time about movies too. Yeah.
Everything is, yeah. Every plot is it translated to so many different times, you know? Yeah. And I've worked in my career on so many retellings, just so many, and they all are amazing. And I love them. I love retellings, even if they're loose or if they're a hard retelling, like it doesn't really matter. And so I was like, why am I trying to reinvent the wheel? Why don't I just borrow the framework from another story? And so then I started reading a whole bunch of stuff that I had read in the past that I really enjoyed to get inspiration. This didn't take very long, because then I picked up Emma, which was arguably the only classic that I enjoy other than Pride and Prejudice. I'm not a classics person. But within 20 pages of reading Emma, I was like, holy shit. How did I not say this earlier? Like, the friendships, Emma's character was so much like, or I mean, Elliot's character was so much like Emma, and like the dynamics between all the friends and the group and her romantic relationships, it was already there. Like, it already reminded me of Emma. And so I wrote down, it was one afternoon, I was in my kitchen. I have a photo of myself because I had to take a picture of that moment, because I was like, this is going to be the life-changing moment. Because I just furiously hand wrote down on a yellow legal pad this new plot based on everything that I already had. And within 3 months, I had the draft written. 2 months after that, it was sold. It was so fast. Once I knew that it was going to be the Emma framework, and that was like the greatest moment, writing moment. But yeah, so personally, I worked a lot into it because, again, like I said earlier, I've never taken a writing class, so I don't know. I'd never tried my hand at fiction or anything, and I called upon my theater background because I did originally go to Emerson for theater. I auditioned and everything. I ended up switching to marketing, but I was really into theater. And so I, you know, in theater, there's like method acting. And I was like, screw it, let's do some method writing. And I just started with everything that kind of happened to me in college. So with Elliot, it's the stuff that's pulled from my own personal life is a lot of the details. A lot of some of the funnier scenes, not really, you know, the romantic relationship. I mean, some of the romantic relationships, but things like her sisters and her dad and the fact that she went to Emerson, the floor that she lived on, and the auction scene that happened to me. And, you know, I kind of pick and chose what to include from my own life and work it in because a lot of it was just like the funnier stuff. But yeah, the dad, like her family relationships are like, they're just my family. Like, they're just my sisters and my dad.
They're really great, those relationships. And they are. They're really funny. You know, her, especially with Remy, you know, the conversations with Remy are really great about bras and stuff like that are really funny. And
that was a real conversation I had.
I believe you. They all felt real. And so, yeah. Like, it doesn't surprise me to hear that at all, right? And, you know, if anything, I could have used more of those scenes, for sure. I think they were really good. That was interesting too about the Emma thing coming in later in the process. And I love how that was sort of like the light bulb in a way, wasn't it? Just sort of like, not to say that you needed a hook necessarily, but that was sort of like, oh, this is the structure I need.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Which is, if the classics are good for anything, it's racism and structure, right? So
the structure is great. Yeah.
All right. Just so people know what we're talking about, do you still want to practice an elevator pitch, or you want me just to read the summary? Because it's actually not very long, which is nice, by the way. So you can tell whoever did the copy for that. Thank you.
Yeah, my one. I actually wrote that.
Oh, they usually don't. So that's great.
Yeah. No. The quick line is that it's a queer retelling of Emma set at Emerson College. That's like encompasses everything.
It but does. Go ahead. Yeah.
Feel free to read it if you
want. No, people can, people can Google it and look that up. It's not something that's just for the arc or anything. So if anybody wants to know the summary, they can read that, but that's basically it. There is a couple, you know, there's obviously lots that happens while she's there, and she makes some good decisions and bad decisions. And I'm hesitant, and I'm only going to call them mistakes because you actually called them mistakes. And since it's your life, you're entitled to call them whatever you want. But, you know, mistake is just a weird thing because it's, you know, when you're looking at your life growing up and stuff, and because of, it depends how your philosophy, I suppose, but do all these things, you know, sort of, are this the summation of who you are now? And if that's the case, then are they truly mistakes, or are they, you know, just, you know what I'm trying to say? Maybe I'm waxing a little bit too much. I haven't even had any wine yet, but today, but, and I'm a few hours away from being high, but it's an interesting way to put it though. And this is one of the things I really want to talk about with this book. And it's really, we're really going to stay away from all the side characters, because they really are just, you know, side characters, and they're great. I mean, Lucy's great. Mika obviously is a force. You know, there's all, you fill this book with great characters, but there's no real B plot here. It's everything. Everyone's here is to support Elliot in some way, right? Support or you know, help move her story along. So let's focus on Elliot. I also want to say, if Elliot is like the worst thing that can happen at this school, it's a pretty modest school, I think. So all these people there that are like giving her a hard time can fuck off. It's not the college experience that I don't think that.
At Emerson, that's about right.
It's not, okay.
Not a big Ohio State, you know, frat parties and terrible shit happening at stuff like that. At Emerson, everybody is so determined, like has their life plan mapped out so far. It is that type of school. There, if we want a party, we had to leave campus and go all the way to a complete, like near BU in order to party. We had to go to other colleges to party.
Okay.
Not to say that, like, you know, shit didn't happen in the dorms at Emerson, because of course it did, but it wasn't, people won't go to Emerson to like rave at frats.
Understood.
It's just not that type of place.
There was also a good, there's a lot of focus too on action on the educational part of it too, which was, which was good. So
that part was actually hard, because that's the biggest difference between Elliot and myself, was that I was one of those kids that went to Emerson with like a 5-year plan.
You did. Okay. Okay.
Oh yeah. I knew exactly what I was doing.
Because that, yeah. Like in that sense, Elliot, again, sort of stands out from the bunch as somebody who doesn't have, like, okay, so like you said, the next 5 years planned out and isn't even, and she kind of thinks she knows what she wants to do, but she's not even sure how to accomplish that goal.
She's confident and she'll figure it out.
Yeah.
But the difference is that, like, I was sort of like that in high school. That's sort of where that experience came from, because I just did not give a shit about academics when I was in high school. But once I got to college, I realized that, like, that was not going to fly.
So
that's sort of what she learns as well, is that everything that's been sort of helping her skate by until now, like, it's probably not going to work anymore. You know, she's gotta put in a little bit of effort.
It's adult time. It's
exactly.
It's adult time. Yeah. Elliot, she's not a monster, despite what maybe some people might think if they read this book, men mostly. She's barely a disaster, in my opinion. People aren't going to like her, I think.
Right.
And I think that's also the point. I also think that she's very sort of like pervicacious. You know what I mean? Like, definitely she's obstinate. She's stubborn. Mm-hmm. When something happens to her in this book at some point, when, you know, something does happen to her, for sure, that's a serious issue. How we react, I think, is going to determine a lot about who we are, us, me, the reader. Mm-hmm. If you get to that point in the book and you react with indifference or worse, I really think it's time to fucking take a look at yourself in the mirror. And I really think that is, if there's any takeaway from this book, I think it's that you can have your opinions. You can think of Elliot as any way you want. Cause this book, there's a lot of sort of, there's slut shaming in it. There's sex positivity. There's all sorts of stuff like that. If you leave this book though, with again, an opinion towards her and what happens to her as indifference or worse, then you're not somebody I want to talk to. Talk to me about that, about what you want people to take away from Elliot at the end of the day. Because we're talking about you, aren't we?
Yeah.
Not 100%, right? We've established that this isn't like, a minute by minute, you know, this isn't Margot Wood's, you know, memoir.
No.
So,
I think that people tend to judge people too much.
Yes.
And I'm saying that people are going to judge Elliot, but I also think Elliot, and that sort of theme with Elliot, said she judges people too much. She judges situations too much. I think not enough people just let people be who they are. and accept, you know, people make choices that are different from the choices that you would make, and that, you know, they're still worthy of respect, even if you think that they're wrong.
I think that people really get confused when we talk about the difference between, you know, core values, personality traits, character traits, even. And I think that people need to understand that core values are just ideas. They're no more than ideas, right? I can sit in my basement up here in Toronto all day long and say how much I hate racism. I could say that to the wall all day long, but that doesn't solve anything, right? That's a core value, right? You could say Steve's core value is that he hates racism. Now, am I willing to do anything about it? That's a personality trait. That's a character trait, right? That's when we get into personality traits describe your actions, whereas character traits describe more who you are. So I think people need to be careful when they mince those words, especially when it comes to a character like Elliot, who by design has all three of those things. And in a good way, I'm talking. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think that we, this just circles right back to the point you just made about judging people. I think we need to learn the differences, and I think we need to learn the definitions before we start judging people a little bit harshly, too harshly.
I agree.
So knowing all of this, knowing this is going to be, you know, a tough subject to tackle, and people are going to come at it with different ways, because you make a decision in this book about something that happens to her, about what to do about it, what not to do about it. Mm-hmm. This is tough to talk about without, I know it's, we're trying to stay non-spoiler if we can, but I think you explain it well enough for the decision you do make. And I think because everyone's situation is different, and I can sit here all day long and say, this person should have done this, or don't let this person do that, or get away with this, or whatever. But I completely understand the situation that some people are put in, and that sometimes it's easier just to go left instead of right.
Yeah. Without it being too much of a spoiler, I mean, This plot point is also rooted in the Emma plot.
Right.
And, you know, Mr. Elton makes a move onto Emma that she does not want, nor did she invite. So this is sort of the college version of that. I struggled with this a lot. I struggled with this so much because A, if I even included this plot point, would it drag the story down too much? B, if she does report it, then it changes the entire framework of the book. The book becomes about that. And I didn't want the book to become about that. I wanted to show somebody who can have that experience and choose to not let that experience define them and move on past it, while still also getting a little bit of retribution in there. And that to me is much more honest, especially because we tend to romanticize, you know, about like, oh, if you've been assaulted or something, like you should absolutely report it, blah, 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 all this stuff. And that's not always the right choice for everybody. And that's the truth. I think we would all love to be in a place where we could report, you know, things that happened to us, but we also, that would be ignoring the truth, which is that especially in a college setting with the Title IX restrictions and things like that, reporting an assault becomes, it literally would take over your life. It would.
If you're believed at all.
If you're believed at all.
Yeah.
And in this situation, Elliot has no evidence. There are no witnesses. And she does tell her RA. There is a record of it. She doesn't, you know, press charges or anything like that. And also she does, I mean, quite frankly, she also does own him in the moment.
Right. Oh yeah.
She controls the situation, you know, like,
and lives are altered potentially forever because of it.
Exactly. You know, so, and it does wrap up neatly and, you know, he drops out and things like that. And so that there's the record, you know, it's on there, but
here's my, and this is just my opinion on it, and this is where I'm going to disagree with you just a little bit. I think it does grind the story to a halt. I think it should. I think it should grind the story to a halt. It absolutely should. I think, if you know what I'm saying. Too many stories don't grind it to a halt, and then all of a sudden we move on too quickly. And this is where I think your format is genius in a way, because immediately after, you almost turn to the camera, and it's acknowledged, it's talked about, it's discussed, it's explained and explained and explained away again. And I think that's the right fucking way to do it. I think, the story should stop.
I agree. It should stop.
It should stop. If that doesn't bring a story to a halt, what the fuck does? I don't know. And again, you know, not this type of format, again, this sort of meta fourth wall stuff, fourth wall breaks, is not common, right? For sure.
Right.
But so we got to find another way to do it in a way that does acknowledge what just happened without the story moving on in a way that happens in so many books that I read, and it fucking drives me nuts. And I really, 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 really appreciated the way that you did it. And I thought it was thoughtful.
Oh,
and I thought and I thought it was spot on. And I would like to see more people do it. And
yeah,
if not that sounds awful. I would love to see more of these in books. No, I don't want to see any more of them in books if I don't have to, but that means hopefully they're not occurring or they're occurring less. But if it is part of the story, which is, you know, it's your story to tell, but acknowledge it. Stop the book in its tracks. It should, because it would for her. Right?
Exactly. So, it had to. Yeah, the book had to come to a halt. Because,
It has to.
How is Elliot? I mean, this had to happen because, like, otherwise, how is Elliot really going to grow? Like, otherwise, she's just going to keep doing her forever. Right. You know?
And I mean, and let's be honest. And I, like, even sort of as we're sort of getting to that moment and you know, your belly starts to turn even before you get to it because you can sense that it's coming. Right.
Yep.
It could have been a lot worse. Right?
And you
showed a lot of restraint and a lot of respect for the subject matter, and I think that was really great the way you handled it. So,
thank you.
This book is a lot of fun, though.
Yeah, it is. I know it's hard. It's hard to promote it because there was a little serious moment, but overall, it's fun.
Right. So, but I mean, it's. I think the best way, you know, I think is that this book is just like you talk about this in the book too. It's just like, it's just, this is real. It's real life. It's messy, right?
It's ugly.
It's ugly. There's weird things like tender chicken, which is, you know,
also came from reality.
Right. Is it? Did it? Okay. That's hilarious.
Oh yeah.
Which is
it's fine. A family saying. It's hilarious. Really? That it's so funny to me that people are now actually like using it
in
their posts and stuff. And I'm just like, yes.
It didn't ruin anything for me because I'm a vegan, so I don't eat chicken anyway, so it doesn't matter. But wonderful. This book is full of really great things. Elliot is really fucking funny, and she's chaotic and and she's a disaster. But you know, there's just no way she commands your attention. It's like Lucy. Mm. Like you put Lucy and Elliot in any other context, and they're not hanging out. Probably not. You know what I mean? Like, they're just too different. They come from different worlds, but you put them in a vacuum, right? And you put them in a contained space, and you give them a second to just sort of like really look at each other and listen to each other. And of course they're going to be best friends. It makes total sense. Right. So you just know like those two are going to go on and do great things. There's no doubt about it. So.
Oh yeah. But if they weren't roommates, no, they would have never been friends.
Well, that's no, exactly. That's what I mean. Right. So, but it's so amazing that they were, and they helped each other, which was nice. Cause at first, of course, you know, we think Lucy's has got nothing to offer in this relationship. What could she possibly do? Right.
Exactly. Elliot.
But it turns out she's got, she's a firecracker too. Lucy's pretty awesome. This is going to come out the week of the release, probably a couple of days after. Looking at your website, you've got it already, your week's filling up there with events, which is great. Yeah. No, that's amazing. And you've got some really great, looks like you've got some great people with you here. Where are we here? Oh yeah, nice. You've got Abigail on the 3rd, Veronica on the 4th. Yeah, so margotwood.com has already got a bunch of events filling up. Probably going to throw a few more in there, I would imagine, at some point.
I'm actually got one in-person event in Boston, which is exciting. The Boston Book Festival invited me to come out, and I'm very excited for
October
that.
16th.
October. Yeah.
I have a ticket and a hotel for Y'all Fest, and
I didn't get the invite. I'm so sad.
Call them. Just say I'm coming. Say screw you. Invite me.
They included me in Y'all West, like the virtual thing. So I think they're, you know.
Yeah. I'm not gonna say I'm nervous, but like with the way
I'm nervous too.
I know. I don't know. I'm like, and I really want to go. So I don't.
The news isn't great.
I know.
COVID stuff these days. So
it's not till November, right? So
I just got the one. Yeah, the one Boston Book Festival event, and it's outdoors. And
right. So I'm really hoping by November things are going back in the positive direction, but.
Me too. Honestly, I was so bummed that I didn't get to go on a tour for this book because I had plans for what I was going to do.
As somebody, you know, you've helped so many debut authors have great, you can never get that back, right? That first book.
Nope. And can't get that back.
Good God, I talked to so many last year and I'm just like, oh, my heart breaks for them because I have this weird fetish where I love seeing people meet people they admire.
Yeah.
Like, not me. I don't care if I do. I just love seeing the emotion between people. And I love seeing lines.
I miss seeing the readers. Because, like, with my work with Epic Reads, I used to do a ton of events for authors, you know, and it was always so much fun to meet the readers.
Is there anything better than seeing someone come up and just, like, start crying and say how much they love their book and it's affected their life in this way? It's so great. The energy. It's just, so, yeah, I'm missing that big time. And I'm cautiously optimistic about November and Y'all Fest. We'll see. But I don't know. As of right now, it's booked. So whatever, you know, I don't know. We'll see. So in person,
fingers crossed for
you. October 16th for Boston Book Festival in person. Mm-hmm. That'll be your first one, you said?
Yeah, that's my first, probably my only in-person event. So
well, this is really cool. I mean, you spent years, like I said, on the other side of the microphone, and now you get to be asked questions, and I'm so happy for you, Margot. And
thank you.
I think you can tell I'm not prone to bullshit. So this is, I really, really, really enjoyed Fresh, and
thank you. And, I appreciate that.
And I think we were deft enough. I think we avoided anything really spoilery, and it's full of so many really fucking, like, those, it's almost like a meatballs, like an 80s like teen sex romp thing. Like, it's full of it's full of all those amazing, wonderfully awkward, funny moments between humans, young humans, right? Like, and you know, and there's tons of great representation in this book, obviously. And for Emma fans, you get your nightly. I won't say who. There is a nightly.
There is a nightly.
Yeah. And it's just full of all these wonderful, just like awkward, funny, gross, you know, like all right. All those great things that we love about all those sort of, you know, sexy teen angsty rom-coms. And it's full of it. And Elliot's a funny, funny person. So I just assume that you are too. Because this is your biography. I know it.
God, no. Legally, it's not my biography.
Have a wonderful launch, Margot.
Thank you.
And then I think you know too. Again, you see, because you're hip to the scene. You're not going to get any sleep the night before. But
God, I haven't slept in like 2 months. Are you kidding me? I'm a salesperson. I'm like literally like looking at. I'm like every day. I'm like, what are my sales? What are my sales?
It's such a weird thing, isn't it? Now you're on that side of it. It's so cool, though. It's like
the best I can hope for is God, just at least let me midlist, you know? Like, I just, the worst that could be is that you write a great book that just sells it nothing.
Right. That's right. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, anyways, well, you're already working on another one. You said it's an adult, so that's
yeah, I have no idea. I'm waiting for this book to come out.
I'm not asking for details. I'm just saying you're already.
Oh, no. I literally have not written anything yet because I'm ADHD, so I tend to do an all or nothing type of writing. I'm not a write every day type of person, so I'm waiting for Fresh to come out so I can like mentally do my method writing thing and like put myself into the head of the next person. Whatever I end up writing though, it's going to be comedy because that's just my default.
So
I'd love to like play around either with like I grew up on Mel Brooks. I'm a huge Mel Brooks fan. Yep. And you know, his take on different genres is like my favorite. And I love when people do that in literature. So like, you know, maybe a comedy fantasy or something.
That would be great.
Yeah. Who knows?
Are you signed though for anything? Or like, are you under contract for anything or no?
No,
you're not. Okay.
Specifically only wanted a one book deal. Cause I've worked in publishing long enough to see a lot of authors sign on with a publisher for like 3-4 books and their first book doesn't sell well. And then they are locked in with that publisher and vice versa. And it just is bad news bears after that. So,
well, see, that's some good advice right there too. I mean, it's cause it's so hard. Cause I mean, you know, these, when you're young and hungry and someone's offering you the world essentially. And you're like, yes. Yep. And the next thing you're like, oh shit.
Exactly. I didn't want to, you know, I wasn't, like I said, I've only written one thing. So who knows if I can even write a second. I don't want to be committed to anybody.
I mean, 3-book deals are getting rare and rare, but it's a
two book is very common.
There's tons of twos. Yeah. So, I mean, just that's some good advice. Even no matter how hungry or eager you are to get your first book out into the world, just make sure it's still the right situation for you. And
I'd also take, you know, advances into consideration. A lot of authors just want like the big money up front. And for me, that was not what I was looking for.
Right.
I was like, I would much rather earn out than be a bad investment.
Do you really still love, you know, your profession? Do you ever see yourself being just a full-time author? Like, is that a dream? Is that even in the universe for you? Or
publishing is hard because you do so much work for very little pay. And it's pretty impossible to, it takes a long time to work up to like a really good salary, which is sort of why I left New York, to be honest. Because I was just like, you know, this is not long-term affordable. So I moved to Portland, which is much better compared to New York.
And there's trees in Portland.
And there's trees. Oh, yeah, it's nice.
Been there. It's beautiful there. Yeah.
I do love publishing. I don't know that I'll stay on the marketing side because marketing is, in my career, feel like I've now been in it long enough to be jaded, enough to be like, you know, marketing people are the last to get thanked if a book does well, and the first to get blamed if it doesn't sell well.
Right.
It is never, I've rarely experienced anything other than that. And that's hard to sustain day in and day out for over a decade.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'd like to stay in publishing because I'm a person who needs a day job. I need structure.
Right.
I would love to be. Are you kidding me? Like a fresh soul, like so much that I could quit my day job. That'd be like, sweet.
Right.
But then I'd probably end up some kind of part-time job or doing something with publishing. So I don't know. That's kind of the whole, my whole life theme is I just kind of figure it out as I go. You know, I fell into publishing. I didn't major, you know, I didn't read a book until I was 25. So, I fell into this. So who knows where I'm going to fall next?
Well, whatever it is, whatever you call this crazy system, the wood system, it's working for you. So,
oh, thank you.
Again, congratulations on your debut and yeah, all the best, Margo, and have a really, really great release. There you have it. Another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to Margo for taking the time to speak with me today. I had such a great time. Fresh, almost more than anything, is a conversation starter, and I believe it is as important as it is entertaining. And it is entertaining, that's for sure. Fresh is out now, so head on over to margowood.com to order a copy today. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please, continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.